Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
So welcome to New Books in Critical Theory, which is a podcast that's part of the New Books Network. On this episode, I'm talking to Agnelle Christin, who is an assistant professor in the Department of Communication at Stanford University, about her new book, Metrics at Work, Journalism and the Contested Meaning of Algorithms. So welcome to the podcast.
Hi, welcome. Thank you.
This is a great book. It's really, like, it's perfectly timed given the fact that we're in the middle, like almost kind of globally, of people asking questions about journalism and asking questions about algorithms. So I think, you know, in some ways it's almost the perfect book to speak to these public concerns, but also it's a really serious bit of academic work as well, which, you know, is really important, I think. And I guess the place to start is maybe around what the subject of the book actually is, because I guess when people hear the term like metrics or they hear the term algorithm, like they kind of know what it means, but actually you've got a very kind of specific thing that you're focused on, which is around how metrics and analytics I guess used as kind of resources for journalists. So it'd be good to clear the ground about what it is that these things actually are.
Sure. So basically, when the news started moving online, right? So like when journalists started publishing articles online, and when news organizations created websites for their articles to share it with an online audience, they started relying on what's called web analytics or audience metrics, which are basically fine-grained digital data about what online users are doing online on the website at any given moment. And so in the book, I talk about one of the most popular of these of the software programs that provide these web analytics, and it's called Chartbeat. So Chartbeat was created in New York in 2009, and it basically provides very detailed data about the audience to journalists themselves. So typically you have like a kind of dashboard, and the dashboard shows how many readers are on the website at any given point in time. It's like updated every couple of seconds. And so you get this really kind of fine-grained data about traffic. And it also provides a lot more information. For instance, a ranking of the most popular articles, again, in real time, right? So you can see which of the articles currently online on the website get the most attention, get the most traction with online readers. It also gives information about how long do readers stay on an article. And that's actually a pretty depressing number for most journalists, because the average time engaged, it's called, so time engaged with any given piece of content, is like under 1 minute, right? So like usually it's around 53, 54 seconds. And then it also gives information about where readers come from. So like how they access the article. Did they find it on Twitter or on Facebook? Did they go through the homepage? Did they search for some of the key terms on Google and then got to the article through Google's search results, etc.? And so what's really interesting is that this kind of software program, so these kinds of analytics software programs, have really changed the relationship between journalists and their readers. And here, I think that a tiny bit of background is important. Traditionally, of course, news organizations had metrics about the audience, right? That's what marketing departments do. And that's what news organizations need to sell advertising space to brands, right? They need to be able to say, hey, like, look, our audience is like, has these kinds of segments. We cater to like urban men between 35 and 55, you know, and that's how they're going to price their advertising space. But these kinds of traditional metrics in print journalism were only used in marketing departments, and they were pretty broad, right? So they were really about the audience as a whole, and they were certainly not in real time and not as detailed as what can be gathered online through server data. And so with the kind of move to online news, one of the big transformations is that suddenly journalists and editors were able to see this very detailed information about what their readers liked, what they didn't like, which articles were popular with the audience and which articles were not popular with the audience. And here, like unsurprisingly, they were in for a couple of big surprises. Namely that some of the articles that are the most prestigious, some of the topics that are the most prestigious in newsrooms do not do so well with the audience. Whereas articles that are not, and topics that are not so prestigious within newsrooms, in fact, are very popular with readers. And so here we can take a couple of, you know, paradigmatic examples, articles about Kate Middleton or Kim Kardashian or, you know, whomever kind of celebrities you want to pick, typically do not are not very prestigious in terms of journalistic values, but they do really well with the audience, and vice versa. Typically, news about you know, international conflicts, politics, economics, also arts and culture. So that's it depends a bit. That, you know, are typically like more legitimate or more prestigious amongst journalists do not attract as much traffic. So what web analytics are doing is like basically representing this kind of preferences of the audience in a quantitative form at the center of the newsroom and put it literally in front of the eyes of every single journalist who is working on a computer, typing their articles and kind of giving them that information about what the public prefers.
I mean, this is a story that people will be familiar with. And I guess, you know, it's the kind of story where we'd move pretty quickly to say this is what has like killed journalism and, you know, the old kind of like, you know, sort of vision of a quality broadsheet newspaper has been destroyed by these kind of, you know, clickbaity, almost, you know, sort of like fast food style, giving the readers the, you know, the kind of basest and worst sorts of kind of subjects and delivered in these, you know, kind of eye-catching and, you know, arresting ways to generate both clicks and, you know, time spent on the page. And one of the things I really like about the book is the book says, well, hang on, like, is that even true? And at the center of the book's analysis is both, I guess, a kind of a framework for understanding what journalists actually think and how they actually behave, but also thinking about, you know, almost the kind of the set of institutions or we might say the kind of the field of journalism and how it's responded. So before we kind of get into the examples that you draw from the States and from France, it's probably worth spending a little bit of time thinking about, I guess, the kind of the broad, what we might think of as kind of like theories of judgment and theories of evaluation that animate part of the journalistic field and certainly animate your case studies. And one of these is what you call a kind of editorial approach, and the other one is the kind of click-based approach. So what are they and why, I guess, do they you know, kind of matter in understanding the impact of digital on journalism?
This is a really good question. And so just to kind of go back a tiny bit about what you were saying about like, oh, like, you know, there is a familiar story about kind of the decline of journalism and journalism going down the drain and towards kind of more clickbait and kind of fast foody type of content. The use of the food metaphor, by the way, is just so interesting when we think about quality news, etc. I won't go too much into it, but it's just really interesting. So I think that like, yeah, so basically like the book really argues against like kind of what we could call like two kind of broad kind of preconception of what's going on. The first one is, oh, it's the end of quality information. Everything's going to get worse. It's all clickbait content. And, you know, it's just like we don't have the good old newspapers, the good old quality newspapers that we used to have. And therefore, like, you know, the future is doomed, kind of. The other story, which I'm equally kind of opposed to, is like, oh, there is nothing new. Journalism has always been both a business and a kind of public good. That's been the case since the early 19th century in all countries, right? Except in places where journalism is more of a public institution, and I'm happy to talk more about that. But, you know, there is always this kind of tension between, shall we say, market and professional forces, right? And that's, and so there is nothing new with online news. And so basically what the book tries to do is to be like, well, it's like what sociologists usually do. It's like, well, a kind of in-between road. Like, as in like, no, some things are changing, but not everything is changing. And that's kind of that, shall we say, gradual process of change and uneven process of change that's kind of at the center of the book. And so to make sense of it, I basically argue that the best way to understand what's going on within newsrooms right now, and that's based on 4 years of ethnographic fieldwork, and we can talk more about this when we get into the details of the book, but like, it's basically that like newsrooms right now are really kind of stuck in a bit of a tense relationship between two different ways of making sense of what's good journalism in the 2010s, right, 2020s. On the one hand, there is what I call this editorial mode of evaluation, which is basically this kind of traditional way of assessing quality in journalistic fields. So typically that means, what's a good journalist and what's a good article? Well, a good journalist and a good article typically are respected by their peers, right? So in that sense, it's a bit like academia. It's like prestige and kind of recognition comes from the peers, so the other journalists. In academia, other academics, obviously, it really is about providing new information, new content, a new angle on a given topic. So it's really about originality and kind of increasing the knowledge that we have about the world. And then basically the main kind of marker of success is to get, say, a compliment or even better, to be imitated by other journalists, right? So typically that would mean either getting a compliment or whatever, like a kind word from your editor-in-chief being like, oh, wow, that was a really important article. I'm so glad we got the breaking news on this. Like, congratulations. Or it meant another news organization being like, oh, you know, say like The Guardian wrote that, ta 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 ta. This is really important because ta 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 ta, right? And so this is a kind of editorial mode of evaluation, which we could also call the kind of professional or like kind of traditional journalistic way of assessing quality. And that's still certainly there in web newsrooms. Right? Journalists in web newsrooms are not, you know, running after clickbait. Many of them care deeply about producing important new content, right? And kind of holding, for example, institutional powers accountable, finding breaking news about topics that people didn't know about, providing incisive angles or like a new analysis of some things that we thought we understand, etc. But, and that's the second part of the analysis, at the same time, news organizations online are also kind of involved in another way of assessing quality. And that's what I call the click-based mode of evaluation. And that in turn, I think, is a bit new. So according to the to this kind of click-based mode of evaluation, really the primary goal of a journalist is to resonate with the audience, right? It's to attract the attention of the public. It's to be in sync with the public. And so what does that mean? Well, that means typically having your article go viral on social media. It's getting a lot of comments, a lot of tweets, a lot of retweets, a lot of likes. It's about being in the buzz, right? Having a kind of clicky headline, getting people interested, and kind of attracting the attention of what I call algorithmic publics. So these publics that are online, that are dispersed through and mediated through algorithmic procedures on social media platforms primarily. And so coming to the website or coming to the article through Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, etc. And so that's really what I talk about in the book, is how news organizations are trying to negotiate the tension between these very different ways of assessing quality in journalism now that everything operates online.
And you've got two case studies for this. One is what you call the notebook, which is in America in New York. And then the other is, I guess, would be Laplace, which is a French site. And what was most interesting was, you know, we could be again, you know, we've talked about the cliches of clickbait and fears about the decline of journalism. You know, we could be quite cliched in that we'd expect, you know, a kind of an aggressive, numbers and metrics driven approach from the American case study, you know, much more to do with that buzz, as you said, that, you know, kind of engagement with the algorithmic public. And then a series of cliches about our French case study about, you know, the kind of clinging to the editorial or, you know, journalistic recognition approach. But actually, what you show kind of wonderfully is how both really face the same dilemmas, the same problems, you know, the same kind of issues around questions of commercial or institutional survival. And, they kind of deal with them differently, and they, you know, they're really obviously distinctive. But actually, you know, you see similar things kind of bubbling up and coming through. And I guess actually, as a way of introducing both case studies, we could pick up on that idea of algorithmic publics, which, you know, in the New York context was about, you know, kind of like commercial traffic and maybe like trusting the numbers to tell the institution what the public were. But in Paris, it was much more to do with, you know, kind of like civic duty and the journalists being a bit more ambivalent. So maybe as a big question, you know, who are the notebook, who are Laplace, and how do they understand the algorithmic publics?
Sure. So when I started this project, I had in mind this idea that, like, when we think about digital technologies, when we think about the internet and about all the algorithmic procedures that, shall we say, make the internet work, right? We tend to think about these processes in terms of like global standardization. So basically, and you'll see that in most kind of media headlines and a lot of academic articles, actually, that, you know, because we're transitioning to online platforms and online mediation, everything and everybody's becoming more similar, right? And typically everybody's obsessed with clicks, everybody's trying to go viral. And in the case of journalism, news organizations are going through this kind of standardization process where news headlines and articles content are becoming more increasingly similar with the kind of diffusion of the internet. And so I wanted to like see if that was really the case. And so to do that, I picked news websites in two countries that are often described as having the most kind of opposite kinds of journalistic traditions. And that would be the US and France. Of course, there is also a backstory behind it, which is that I'm French and I did my PhD in the US. And so that was also a very convenient reason to go back and spend a couple of years in Paris. And there is always this kind of backstories behind comparisons, but the comparison was also justified by the fact that journalism in the US and France has like these very different features. And I can go pretty quickly around it, but basically journalism is often, in the US, is often characterized as being primarily dominated by market pressures. So extremely strong market pressure, strong kind of financial pressure starting in the 1980s with the development of kind of media conglomerates that really took over the journalistic landscape in the United States. And also in the American context, a very strong kind of professional definition of what it means to be a journalist, right? With like professional associations, with very strong journalistic schools, with very strong kind of norms surrounding journalistic professionalism. For example, the norm of objectivity. So the idea is that journalists have to be objective and they have to do the pros and cons of every single topic, etc. Whereas in the French context, traditionally, the way in which French journalism has been described is more as a public-oriented or a civic profession, right? So that, you know, following the kind of Dreyfus affair in the late 19th century, really French journalists see themselves as being in charge of guiding public opinion and shaping the public debate. And of course, that goes with the fact that there are much lower market pressures in the French context for a range of reasons. But one of the main ones is that media production is very much protected and funded by the state. So there are there is a strong public broadcast system like in the UK, and there are many subsidies both for news organizations and for journalists, protecting them from the pressure of market forces. So for all of these reasons, I was like, oh, that's interesting. Like, so let's compare perhaps news websites in the two countries and how they deal with analytics and audience metrics, right? So do we see a kind of this process of convergence and standardization that people are talking about and like, you know, oh, everything's going kind of clickbaity, it's awful, it's the end of journalism, or do we see a difference based on these kind of distinct traditions of journalistic professionalism, and what can we do there? And so what I did to study that, so I'm an ethnographer, which means that I do primarily interviews and observations. And so I ended up doing kind of intensive ethnographic fieldwork in a total of 5 newsrooms in New York and in Paris. And the book eventually focused on 2 of these newsrooms. So one in New York, which I call The Notebook, and the one in Paris, which I call La Place. So there are lots of reasons to compare these 2 newsrooms. And here, you know, I get into this whole kind of methodological thing about how can you compare things that are comparable. And I'm happy to talk more about that. But one way of saying it is just that, so they are both online-only newsrooms. They both rely exclusively on advertising revenues to kind of sustain themselves. And advertising revenues in turn like depends on traffic, right? It's like the more traffic you get, the more revenues you get. And so they both kind of started paying a lot of attention to traffic numbers in 2009-2010. They were both created between 2006 and 2009. Obviously, I use pseudonyms. So this is not the real name of the 2 publications. People can find out what the actual names of these publications are, but I think that it's really important to use pseudonyms, in part because it allows us to think more in analytical terms rather than just like, oh, it's this website. Well, I know what they do, like, you know, and I don't care, whatever. So like, there is a big component of my project why I care a lot about anonymizing the websites and the individuals that I studied. And so, based on this comparison, I found a couple of things that are really important. And that goes into the question about algorithmic publics that you asked, Dave. And sorry, this is, I guess, a bit of a circuitous response to the question.
It's perfect, actually, because we now have exactly the scene for this question of algorithmic publics and, you know, how, on the one hand, New York, you know, seemingly has got like a really distinctive, really kind of American approach, and Paris has this, distinctive French approach. And maybe if you set up those 2 things, we'll kind of like interrogate them and take them apart a bit afterwards.
Cool. So basically, so I started spending time in the two newsrooms, and I guess the way in which I analyze it in the book is that I talk about this as a process of like divergence within convergence, in the sense that there are strong forces towards convergence that kind of bring the two websites a bit closer to each other in what they do and how they deal with traffic metrics. But at the same time, there are also really important differences. So let me talk a tiny bit about the convergence side first and then move to the kind of differences. So first on the convergence side, what I found, and I guess that's pretty obvious since the book is really about that, is that metrics play a crucial role in both of these newsrooms that I studied. So that was fascinating, right? So I traveled back and forth between New York and Paris. So two newsrooms were very different. You know, one of them was in Manhattan. The other one was like in the northeast of Paris in like a publicly funded building. One of them was like part of this much broader kind of media conglomerate. The other one wasn't until it was. But what's interesting is that the two newsrooms used exactly the same software program to measure traffic numbers. And that software program was the one that I mentioned before, Chartbeat, right? So they used the same dashboard and they had the dashboard opened on their screens at about the same times. And so they were using the same metrics, the same programs, the same kind of visualization of traffic numbers, etc. So that was kind of interesting. But more interesting was the fact that in both newsrooms, I found this very strong tension and conflict and doubt and fear about this kind of complicated dance between the editorial and the click-based mode of evaluation that I mentioned earlier, right? So in both places, editors and journalists like talked very often about like, oh, but should we publish this? This article is not really interesting journalistically speaking, but it's going to do great in terms of traffic. So what do you think? Should we do it? And then someone else would be like, oh, I don't know. Like, I guess, well, you know what? Like, we're publishing this other article, which is really important journalistically speaking, but that's not going to do well in terms of traffic. So we have this kind of buying off one for the other, right? So we're going to publish this kind of trashy piece that's going to do great in terms of traffic. And this is going to kind of, shall we say, pay for this other piece, this other article, which is about, say, Syria and the civil war in Syria that no one's going to read. But we all agree as journalists that we should publish something about this because it's important, right? So I kept seeing in the two newsrooms these kind of discussions about, like, how do you kind of negotiate and how do you kind of balance click-based and editorial imperatives? And how do you use kind of cross-subsidization processes where like one clicky article is gonna, one click-oriented, click-baity type of article is gonna pay for, in a way, one kind of journalistically ambitious article and vice versa, right? So like in both newsrooms, there was this complicated dance between the two things. And in both newsrooms, what I saw, and that's to your question, Dave, is that journalists really paid close attention to the preferences of their algorithmic public. So again, these publics, these audience members, these readers, mediated through these algorithmic procedures and represented by Chartbeat and the Chartbeat dashboard in the newsroom. And so it was really interesting because they kind of kept track of what readers were thinking and what how they were behaving and what kind of preferences they had. And based on that, they tried to kind of, shall we say, tweak their content to better address the preferences of these readers, right? So typically, they would be like, huh, it's interesting. You know, we published a couple of articles about that niche topic, and turns out they got pretty popular, in fact, like, you know, like quite a number of readers clicked on them and liked them and then commented on them. So perhaps we should put the journalist on this beat, which we weren't covering before, but I guess there is an audience for that. And so we should probably cater to this. And this is also an important topic. It would be nice to have kind of a vertical or have like a segment of the website about this. So, and that's exactly the kind of like iterative process where like journalists would pay closer attention to what readers were doing that I saw in both countries, right? Both at the Notebook and Laplace. So that's kind of on the convergence side. But of course, there were also important differences. And that's, you know, always a kind of point of comparative studies is that, you know, you kind of you get interested in differences because, you know, when you compare, you're always going to find differences. And so on the kind of distinction on the different side, basically what I found was that, so it's like a finding in two levels. So the first striking finding, especially given the different traditions of journalism in the US and France, what I was expecting going into the field and starting to spend time in the two newsrooms was that Americans would be obsessed with traffic numbers and would try to maximize them, whereas French journalists would be super critical of traffic numbers and would say like, ah, this is so bad, it's really trashy, like, you know, I don't want to deal with this. So I was expecting this kind of caricatural, like, you know, French versus American way of dealing with market pressures, right? Whereas in fact, what I found when I started spending time during my ethnographic fieldwork in the two newsrooms, it was kind of the opposite, which was really strange. In the sense that in the New York newsroom at the Notebook, journalists basically, they were aware of metrics. They definitely knew what the metrics were, but they weren't super attached to them. And they weren't really fixating on them. They were like, oh yeah, metrics. Ah, that's really annoying, but it's part of the job now. But you know, at the same time, like, I don't really care. I think that my job as a journalist is to write good articles, articles that, you know, are going to get me promoted eventually. So articles with good content that my colleagues and my editor in chief like. I don't have to deal with this market pressure stuff. That's the job of editors and marketing departments. It's not my job as a journalist, right? So that was the kind of thing in the US newsrooms, which was this kind of strong division of labor and kind of professional protection, shall we say, where journalists were saying, no, no, I have to focus on my craft. And my craft is to write good articles. So metric stuff, that's not for me to maximize. That's not for me to pay attention to. That's a job of editors in chief and marketing departments and all of these people. And it's their job, not mine. So that was kind of the New York kind of newsroom situation. Whereas in the French newsroom, in the Parisian newsroom, La Place, it was kind of the opposite in a way, in the sense that everybody was kind of fixating on traffic metrics. So Chartbeat was open at all the time on everybody's computer. They, as soon as a journalist published an article online on the website, they would open Chartbeat and see how the article was doing in terms of popularity. They kept making jokes about traffic numbers, as in like, ah, well, this topic, like, for sure, you're going to get a million clicks. Like, well, as my topic, like, you know, is not going to get a million clicks because it doesn't talk about sex. Like, ha, ha, ha. And so they would have this, like, fixation about metrics that had really become like a kind of fixture of the informal life of the newsroom. And it was interesting in the French context because they were also very critical of metrics. So it was a kind of a double-sided attitude, right? So on the one hand, they fixated on metrics. And in fact, they kept talking about them, etc. But then during the interviews or even with each other, they would also have a very critical discourse about metrics, comparing it notably to prostitution. And that was a very interesting kind of metaphor, a bit like the food metaphor that we mentioned earlier. So the way the French journalists would talk about that would be like, oh, chasing clicks is like selling oneself. It's really prostitution. It's really trashy. So trashy was a word that like kept coming back. And kind of talking about it in terms of like, selling one's body and one's dignity, which is a very specific way of thinking about prostitution too, to get kind of higher traffic. And so I ended up having this kind of like really surprising and paradoxical findings. And so the rest of the book is basically kind of making sense of why these two newsrooms reacted in such different ways to the rise of web analytics. And part of the answer, I think, has to do with these algorithmic publics and how they're being perceived by journalists journalists in the US and France. And so to go pretty quickly here, I think that in the US, and that's in part because of this kind of long kind of tradition of market pressure and professionalization kind of side by side, or to put it a bit differently, the fact that journalists in the US professionalized, became more professionalized as a reaction and as a way to defend themselves against commercial encroachments on their craft, that, you know, in the US, basically, the way in which journalists made sense of algorithmic publics was only as a kind of commercial entity. A commercial entity that was important to get revenues for the website, right? So a commercial entity that was measured, tracked, targeted by specific algorithms that would provide specific kinds of ads and price them differently. But an algorithmic public that didn't matter much for the journalists' kind of conceptions of themselves, right? What American journalists really cared about at the website I studied was the opinion of their peers. And so interestingly, for example, they cared a lot about Twitter because all the journalists are on Twitter. And so they cared a lot about having other journalists on Twitter like, tweet or retweet their articles, but they didn't care about the public at large. The public at large was a commercial, primarily a kind of commercial object that was to be, shall we say, maximized or optimized for commercial purposes, right? Whereas in the French context, the way in which journalists made sense of these algorithmic publics was really that, you know, clicks represented, and here it's a bit of a caricature, but you know, clicks represented almost like the nation, right? Or it represented public opinion. And as such, because they saw themselves as public intellectuals in charge of guiding opinion, right, in charge of directing, of helping, of politicizing, etc., this kind of public opinion are broadly considered at the national level, they paid very close attention to clicks because they saw these clicks and this traffic number as the best kind of symbol or the best measurement, the only measurement that they had, really, of their impact in the public sphere. And as such, they fixated on it, right? Because it had become kind of woven into their professional identity. And so that's basically the arguments that I develop in the book.
I wonder if you could say a bit about how the organizations function, because again, this is another example of seemingly, you know, very different, very distinctive modes of organization, some which were, I guess, kind of contradictory in what you might not expect, you know, again, going back to what you were saying about the kind of classic version of American journalism and, you know, things like markets. Well, actually, you know, the notebook you describe as a kind of quite, you know, sort of bureaucratic, or at least an organization that uses bureaucracy to govern itself. Whilst, you know, Laplace had this kind of like informal, almost, I guess, you know, panoptic kind of Foucauldian way of like disciplining its staff. And this, you know, bureaucracy and discipline seemed to run, you know, through almost everything, actually, whether it was like decisions about what's published or like how people get paid, you know, these modes of institutional organization were really crucial. And it'd be good to hear about that. I guess that kind of distinction and that difference.
Sure. So yeah. So you know, once I had kind of identified these different ways of dealing with metrics, and you know, knowing that there is this kind of broader kind of macro structural differences between kind of journalistic fields in the US and France, the question was like, well, like, so how does this play out at the organizational level, and how can we kind of characterize the organizational modes of these two news websites, right, the Notebook and Laplace? And there, like, I ended up developing this idea of like bureaucratic versus disciplinary modes of organizations. And so here it really comes from organizational sociology and hadn't been applied to news organizations until this book, I think. But basically going back to, you know, kind of classics in organizational sociology, there is this like distinction between different ways in which organizations structure the production process. And most of this literature is actually about factories and plants and the shop floor and, you know, assembly lines. So not at all about newsrooms, but there are similarities. So the two kind of ideal types of organizations that I found are, on the one hand, this kind of bureaucratic model, and on the other hand, what I call this disciplinary model. So in the bureaucratic model, all the rules are clear. The hierarchies are clear. There are clear sanctions and clear rewards for things. And the idea is that you make your way through a kind of hierarchical organization. Think about like Fordism, for example, right? Which would be kind of a model of bureaucratic organization. And there are like kind of guidelines and templates and organizational charts. And everybody has kind of well-defined roles with a strong kind of division of labor and specialization. And so you kind of move between these different boxes in a kind of hierarchical way. Whereas the disciplinary system doesn't function like that. And here again, of course, this is a reference to Michel Foucault's work, but not only, for example, Gideon Kundau, who is an organizational sociologist, kind of found a similar process in an engineering firm that he studied in the book Engineering Culture. So the disciplinary model is very different. It's about, there are no clear hierarchies. The idea is that you should be able to grow and flourish the way you want, that we're not going to put you in a box. There won't be a strong specialization or division of labor. Instead, it's kind of seen as this kind of organic whole, right? Where like people do what they're interested in, and it's kind of more of a kind of flat level hierarchy, right? So without strong differences between management and workers, etc. And this kind of disciplinary model is found a lot actually in Silicon Valley. So it's found a lot in kind of new technological firms and the kind of startup model, right? We're like, oh, we're all buddies hanging out together and we're all working a lot because it's fun and because we're friends. But in fact, of course, what the previous literature finds about disciplinary kind of cultures is that it also comes with this very strong personal and individualized pressure to perform, right? That somehow the kind of rewards and sanctions are not outside of yourself, like in the organ, like in the bureaucratic model, but instead they're like internalized as an individualized pressure to do better all the time. That can come with pretty serious psychological consequences for the people who don't deal well with that kind of internalized pressure and anxiety. And so, you know, kind of bridging this literature, I was like, oh, it's really interesting because it describes so well what is going on at The Notebook and Laplace, right? So at The Notebook, basically what I found was this very clear kind of bureaucratic structure, in the sense that there was a clear organizational chart with a hierarchy. Editors in chief were on top, and then there were section editors that had very clear roles, and then you had staff writers, and then you had copy editors, and everybody was like very clear about where they were in the hierarchy. And in fact, it was so clear that even the office space was organized with kind of cubicles and dividers following that kind of organizational chart, right? And so as a result, it meant that people were very clear about what their tasks were, right? And where they were in the hierarchy. And so typically, they knew whether like it was their responsibility or not to maximize traffic numbers, right? And they knew, and that's something that we haven't talked about so much so far, but they knew whether they were in charge of writing what I call fast news or slow news. So fast news is more on the kind of click-based type of evaluation. And it's a kind of like short, reactive kind of quick article that's, you know, going to do well in terms of traffic. Whereas slow news at The Notebook was about like writing these long investigative articles or these stories that, you know, could go viral. I mean, it could always happen. But the idea was really that that was what made the editorial reputation of the website, right? And so every single staff writer knew very well where they were on that kind of, shall we say, division between slow and fast news or between click-based and editorial evaluation. There was no doubt about what was expected of them and what they had to do in order to perform well. So that was a notebook. Whereas at Laplace, the French website, the situation was really different in the sense that there was no clear hierarchy. Yes, there was a president, there was an editor-in-chief, and there was a managing editor. But, you know, everybody saw them more as friends and buddies and sometimes even gurus than just hierarchical superiors, right? And even the space of the newsroom was organized basically as a kind of big open space, kind of startup style, where everybody was kind of working with everybody else. Like there was no clear distinction of depending on like one's place in the hierarchy, right? And there, like really, we have to understand that like in part, that's because the founders of the French newsrooms come from the 1968, May 68 culture in France. They were all kind of from the radical left. Several of them had been Maoists before. And so they kind of tried to create this, shall we say, new way of doing news production, right? They were like, oh, we're so tired with this kind of administrative bureaucratic model of big newspapers. We want to be a group of friends. We want to be like a family. And so as a result, that meant that no one in the newsroom, as the newsroom grew over the years, no one had a clear sense of what specifically they were expected to do. They were expected to do everything well. And as a result, they all felt, all the staff writers, all the journalists felt that they had to maximize traffic numbers, that they had to both do quality journalism and to do well in terms of traffic. And they ended up internalizing that pressure to do everything, right? And that may sound familiar to academics in particular, because in a way, I think academics also kind of think that they have to do everything well. And that comes from, that accounts for a lot of some of the psychological problems that, you know, are frequent in academia, because it's this kind of internalization process is not, it's not nothing. It comes with a real cost for the people involved. And so at the French website, at Laplace, I realized that, you know, people kept talking about traffic because they saw traffic numbers as a way to kind of reassure themselves that they were doing well, right? So when they had an article that had done well in terms of traffic, they were like, ah, well, at least like no one can say that I'm not bringing traffic to the website because I did. Look, I got like, you know, 50,000 views, like, ha, great. Well, now I can breathe a bit. And so I saw this kind of internalization and kind of very emotional relationship to traffic, which I think comes from this kind of disciplinary model that was not present in the New York newsroom.
This contrast, I guess, brings us to maybe a concluding question. I mean, there's loads of stuff we haven't touched on. The stuff about pay actually is particularly interesting, and you know, particularly how that exact model, the disciplinary model, means that, you know, everybody is kind of seemingly getting the same, but actually there are loads of exceptions, and it's, you know, this kind of complicated reintroduction almost of problematic forms of, you know, of almost kind of hierarchy. But I'm sort of conscious of getting you to reflect maybe on what the book means more generally beyond the two case studies and the analysis you've already offered. So where do you think the book speaks to, I guess, the kind of future of journalistic practice and, you know, the way journalists and news organizations are responding to metrics, you know, now and in the coming years?
Sure. So I think the book wants to make seeks to make three contributions. And so one is about journalism and the other two are about slightly different things. And so perhaps I'll talk a tiny bit about all three. So in terms of the future of journalism, well, of course, that's like, you know, the kind of $1 million question, right? So a couple of things. So first, I think that, I did field work between 2011 and 2015, and we are now in 2020, for better or worse. So I think that things have changed a bit, since I did, my field work and, kind of got the material for that book, in the sense that, in the meantime, a lot of websites who had primarily kind of capitalized on traffic numbers as a way to make as a way to get revenues have either gone bankrupt or changed their business model radically. And so I think that like now what we see is that there are still some websites that like rely a lot on advertising revenues as a key source of money, but a lot of other news websites have moved more towards a kind of subscription-based model. And so when you have when your revenues is basically half advertising revenue, half subscriptions, online subscriptions, the way in which you use metrics is going to be a bit different, right? Because it's not going to be so much about maximizing traffic numbers, but rather about like how to keep your audience loyal, right? How to kind of have an audience that's going to follow you and will be ready to pay for the kind of content that you provide over the years. And so I think that switched the discussion a bit. And so in a way, I think that like what I saw during my fieldwork was the kind of early years and early, shall we say, fascination / fear about traffic metrics, but that now things have solidified a tiny bit. That said, and even in spite of this kind of evolution, I think that like what my book shows is that really organizational processes are key, right? And that when you are a journalist, when you are a news editor, you have to think very carefully about what kind of incentives you create for staff writers in terms of like what counts as being a good member of the organization and what's the role of metrics in it. And I think that, of course, it's like it's always going to be a double bind, right? On the one hand, you do want journalists to be aware of their readers and to be mindful of their readers. And you want them, to some extent, so not always, to take their readers' reactions into consideration. But at the same time, you don't want clickbait. Or you don't want only clickbait, or you want clickbait to be in the service of more, shall we say, ambitious editorial goals. And so how do you kind of navigate this tension? And I think that the book shows like these two very different ways in which two newsrooms kind of decided to solve that tension between editorial and click-based evaluation. And, you know, I think that gives kind of a range of strategies and solutions that newsrooms may want to adopt or not when thinking about traffic metrics. So that's kind of the journalistic kind of contribution about how are we going to deal with metrics in the future for web newsrooms and yet keep that the quality news, the quality information that we need for democratic life and democratic debate to thrive. The second contribution of the book is more about how do we think about algorithmic technologies more generally. And so here I take the case of web analytics as an example to talk more broadly about all the algorithms that we hear are regulating an increasingly important part of our lives. And so I think that the current debate about algorithms is really interesting and really important, especially showing how algorithms can be biased, how we're increasingly being surveilled online and targeted for advertising purposes, which web analytics are definitely a part of, by the way, and how we're in this kind of state of surveillance capitalism, right? Where algorithms on top of it are increasingly kind of biased and putting us in, shall we say, invisible cages where it's like harder and harder to escape. So for that debate, I think that a really important part of the book's contribution is to show that, yes, we are increasingly using algorithms in our lives, and we're increasingly, our actions and practices and business models and professional practices are increasingly mediated through algorithmic technologies. That said, we need to think about these technologies as symbolic instruments that can be adapted, interpreted, and used for different purposes, depending on local priorities, right? So by showing how journalists in France and in the US made sense of web analytics in these kind of radically different ways, I hope to show that other algorithms can similarly be used, reinterpreted, put into practice, bended for different uses, etc., than what we think about. And so that's an important contribution, especially being based at Stanford University in Silicon Valley, because I think that right now there is this sense, especially among technologists, that, yeah, we're going to solve everything with an algorithm, right? Just put an algorithm on it and, you know, like whatever, all the world's problems are going to go away. And what I think I show is that no, things are not that simple. Well, not only can the instruments be faulty, but even if the instruments were perfect, people on the receiving end, so users, if you want to call them that life that way, in this case, journalists, are also going to use and interpret them in radically different ways depending on the context. And so you have to be very mindful of this when you design technological tools to solve, the world's problems. And finally, the third contribution, and I guess that's like going to my talking a tiny bit about my new project and kind of perhaps ending on that note, is I've become really fascinated by this idea of algorithmic publics. And especially right now with COVID-19 and in the era of social distancing and the fact that most people now spend a lot of their work lives, their social lives, romantic lives, everything lives online, mediated through platforms that rely on analytics and algorithms to function, we need to think about the role of these publics, of these algorithmically mediated publics in shaping what we do and how we interact in 2020. And so my next project is going to be specifically about these algorithmic publics and how they're managed. And so in order to look at that, I've been following influencers. And so that's kind of my next project, where I study influencers on TikTok, Instagram, and YouTube, and trying to understand how they perceive these algorithmic publics and how these algorithmic publics shape the kind of content that they produce, right? And so in an age where we keep hearing about filter bubbles and echo chambers and radicalization on YouTube and Instagram and other platforms, I'm trying to understand, like, what is the role of these algorithmically assembled publics, and how can we kind of better understand what they do for the future of social practice in the digital world.
Will this be a book?
Yes, it will.